Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Court Appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Well, Mike, I saw a couple of things this past week that it just really dampens my spirits as far as the law and the legal system and the loopholes that exist for the criminals.
You're losing faith?
I'm losing faith.
Why?
Well, first one I saw was one of those datelines. You know, I love watching the datelines and all those things where they solve these crimes.
I don't know if you like Dateline more or Judge Judy. I'm trying to figure it out.
I like them both. They both have a warm spot in my heart. I like the way Judge Judy just chews everybody up and spits them out.
They warm the cockles of your heart?
That's right. Got to have your cockles warmed. But in this Dateline, it was a story about, it didn't happen that long ago, it was just a couple years ago, the Ohio State co-ed that was picked up by a guy and raped and murdered in a park right up from where she had been picked up. And then when they found the guy, they found DNA in the car and traced it to a guy who was out on probation. And had found, come to find out, he had also committed, he was out on probation already as a sexual predator.
Right.
I mean, he was registered as a sex offender. He was, he has been convicted of sex crimes. He was wearing an ankle monitor, and he had committed several other attacks since he had been out on probation. He hadn't killed anybody yet, but he had committed several attacks. Yeah, and then he finally gets her and rapes and kills her.
Yeah.
All this time wearing an ankle bracelet, and the family is like, if he wear an ankle bracelet, why wasn't somebody doing something?
Yeah.
Well, we find out these ankle bracelets don't get monitored in real time. They got a GPS on them, and if you want to go back and download what that thing did last month, you can go back and look at it. But as far as somebody saying, hey, this guy's supposed to be under house arrest and he's out wandering around, no, that doesn't happen.
I don't know that's true with all the systems, because I know the ones here in West Virginia, they set up like a perimeter around your house, and if you step outside that perimeter when you're not supposed to be outside that perimeter, it goes off, and they sends them a notice. They know they
it should
know,
be a deadly shock.
Well, no, they know in real time. Here, I'm almost positive they know in real time, because I was actually in a hearing just last Friday where it was a home confinement situation with a elderly gentleman. He was in his 80s, and it was a child pornography case, one of those kinds of cases.
Yeah.
And rather than put him in prison because of his considerable health problems and things like that and costs to the state, the judge said, I'm going to sentence you to home confinement. But this isn't just like, you know, hang out, do whatever home confinement. This is lockdown home confinement. You're not to leave your house without express permission from the home confinement office. And the home confinement office allowed him to go out one time a day to go out to McDonald's to get a sandwich, because he said that was the cheapest way for him to eat, and he had a fixed income, and that was his budget, and he really couldn't cook for himself because he was too old, and that's kind of just how he he lived. He went to McDonald's and got a sandwich, and they said you can get one time a day.
Well, you can get Uber Eats now. He doesn't have to leave at all.
You can get one time a day during this certain time, and if, you know, that's it. And basically, he had violated, and they said numerous times, he had gone to McDonald's, and then he had taken the burger or the sandwich or whatever and gone over to a parking lot to eat it because he said he wanted to eat it while it was still hot. And it just so happened that parking lot was right in front of a Little League baseball field.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like... And they had given this guy numerous chances, and he was, you know, playing... He was kind of playing the elderly, I didn't understand card. But the judge basically said, you know, I tried to give you a chance. You've had numerous warnings. Everything's been explained to you. You've left me with no alternative but to sentence you to prison. So... Man. His home confinement was revoked. But they knew exactly where he was. They knew where he was under, like, sitting underneath a tree in a parking lot right in front of a Little League field. They knew that when he did that, they knew that he was across the river in Ohio. They knew that he was all the way from Wayne County into Barbersville, which is not close. So, I mean, they knew pretty much in real time where he was.
Well, maybe there are some that are, but apparently not all of them are. And that leads to problems if people think, oh, well, this guy, we're okay because this guy's being monitored. No, they're not.
You know, I had another client, too. She lived across the street from a convenience mart. She lived on Route 2 in Lee Sage, and there was a little convenience mart across the street. And she would go over there to, like, just get groceries or things like that without permission, thinking it wouldn't matter. I mean, it's not very far. And they knew that she went over there. And she got busted for that, so...
Yeah, but did they know after the fact, or did they know as it happened? Because you could go back and read it historically.
Yeah, I think they must have known as it happened, because it was pretty quick that they did this. I mean, I don't think they just sit there and say, well, I'm going to check up on so-and-so today and see if they're...
Well, then let's put it this way. Maybe they're doing that here, which surprises me, but they're not in Ohio. And in the other case that they talked about was in New York, where the same type of thing happened.
Really?
And a guy was running around doing all kinds of stuff with an ankle bracelet on, and... Why didn't anybody know about it? They don't monitor it in real time. And they said, usually it's not law enforcement that's monitoring these things anyway. It's a third party that's hired that sells the equipment.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are hired.
No, law enforcement monitors the ones here. So maybe that's the difference. These are actually sheriff's deputies who, that's their job.
Well, that's the way it should be. Once they step outside that perimeter, just shoot them.
I lived in Gainesville, Florida, and one of our favorite places to go is a place called Hogan's. I think it was actually called, at one point, Hogan's Heroes, because it was like a World War II type. Yeah, it was a sandwich shop, but I think they must have gotten sued, because it just became Hogan's. Yeah. But they kept the World War II decor.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they had a lot of really good beers from around the world and things like that. And we would go in there a lot of times to watch soccer games, because they had some TVs and good sandwiches. And there was one guy that was always in there, and we noticed that he had on an ankle bracelet. And so we always tried to figure out how that worked. Like, he must have said he was going to work, and he just went and hung out at Hogan's and drank beer. But he was definitely on home confinement with an ankle monitor, and he was in Hogan's drinking beer all the time.
That's probably because they don't monitor it in real time.
I played darts with him one time.
Huh.
I did not talk to him about the subject of his home
confinement. I'd let him win. Don't take any chances. He might have had an anger issue.
Maybe.
It might have led to it. But then the other loophole.
He was a jovial guy.
I imagine there's jovial criminals.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you don't have to be just a sourpuss to be a criminal. I imagine you could be a happy-go-lucky guy and still commit crimes. Yeah. I mean, you'll see a lot of these ones like the Riddler or the Joker. They're laughing and cracking jokes while they're killing people or beating up Batman or whatever. So
So serious?
Yeah, that's right. Even the Penguin, he'll squawk at him. Wah, 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 wah. But then the other loophole that I saw, this one really got me. A lady was arrested because her husband had been charged with domestic battery. He had used his car. They were getting a divorce. It was a contentious divorce. He had used his car to ram her in her car and run her off the road. So they arrested him for domestic violence. He was in jail for one day. Mm-hmm. She went and got a restraining order while he was in jail to keep him away from her. In that restraining order, it says he's not allowed to have any guns. That was part of the order. But here's the catch. Nobody enforces that. It's up to the guy when he's given the order to go turn in his guns on his own, to pick them up, take them down to the police station, say, here's my guns. How often do you think that happens?
Not very often. I think a lot of times they give it to relatives and things like that, unless the order specifically says they have to give it to.
Or they don't do it at all. You know, and I mean, they should go to the house and perform a search and make sure and seize any weapons. But it's very passive. So this lady, knowing what he's capable of, he had threatened to kill her before. She went to his apartment while he was in jail. She admittedly broke into the apartment. She didn't have a key. It wasn't a joint apartment. Broke into the apartment, knew where he kept his guns, got them, went directly to the sheriff's department or police department, whichever it was, and turned the guns in and said, this is who they belong to, and this is why I got them and brought them in, because I know he'll use them on me. Yeah. They arrested her for armed robbery and put her in jail for 6 days. Now, he's only serving one for running over her with a car, practically, and she goes to jail for 6 days. And they say, it was armed robbery. She went in there and got a gun and committed a crime. And now they got lawmakers. There's a lady lawmaker that's championing her and saying, this is ridiculous. You've got to drop these charges. This cannot be. This
Where
lady
this
was protecting in Florida.
In Florida.
Yeah. This lady was protecting herself and her kids from someone who had, you know, had a history of violence. And this is what we do. There's just no common sense behind these things, and there's no push. You know, the same thing happens with CPS. There was a family here in West Virginia here just last week that their child had been taken away from them at birth because it was born addicted to drugs. The parents obviously were on drugs and everything else, been placed with a foster family. The parents finally, I don't know, do whatever, made the proper thing so that the court gave the baby back to the parents.
They probably did some sort of like drug treatment.
Maybe.
Demonstrated to the court for a period of time that they had corrected the items that led to the filing of a petition to remove the children from custody to begin with.
Yeah, but 3 weeks later, they found this 10-month-old baby in the bottom of a well after the parents, original parents, got the baby back.
Oh.
So, you know, this is not, I mean, things
that
just...
breaks your heart.
I mean, there's just not enough safeguards in place to protect the people that need it. And children and battered women are certainly ones that need that. And I just can't believe that we don't have better safeguards in place for them.
There are some, but it's really hard, especially with a battered spouse syndrome. It's really hard to deal with those situations because a lot of times you have to walk a very fine line because the battered spouse will almost be mad at you for even bringing the subject up because they're defending the batterer.
Right.
So it's a very difficult situation. I've confronted a couple different times, and it's never an easy one to deal with.
Well, but at the same time, you know, on this woman's behalf, she had filed the complaint this time so that he was arrested. And you know what happens a lot of times when they get out, you know, they take it out on the woman for having actually filed the charges before. Like you say, they probably don't do it. They don't say anything because they don't want him taken away. This time she did. She probably knew how he would react. And that's why she went and got the guns.
Or, you know, a lot of times what happens too is they'll file the initial domestic violence petition and then won't show up at the secondary hearing. And it'll be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot.
Because he begs her not to. I'll change. I love you, baby. So, yeah, well, right.
That's kind of a downer type thing. I thought we were talking about property law.
Today. I was outraged, though. Well, this was property. She took his property and gave it to the police.
Yeah. But
so there you go.
Then you talked about that CPS case with a baby in the well.
Well, these are all things that came up this week, and I'm just outraged. That's what I'm saying. I'm losing faith. I'm losing my faith in the laws that are supposed to protect us. They're all out there for the advantage of the criminal. Get off my soapbox now.
Well, let's talk about property law.
All right.
That's always fun to talk about.
Yeah,
everyone loves property law.
That's better than murders and shootings and whatever, babies in wells.
So I'm going to ask you a question to start off with and see if you know the answer to it.
All right.
What is a bailment?
A bailment?
Yeah.
A bailment.
Yeah, do you have any idea what that might be?
Well, it sounds like it has something to do with bail, like when you pay bail to get somebody out of jail or something like that.
It does sound like that, but that is actually not what it relates to. It relates to property law, because we're talking about property law.
Well, it doesn't have to do with bailing water out of a sinking ship, huh?
No, that's what we're doing with the laws here today, evidently, with your disheartened look on life.
Yeah. Well, a bailment is what I don't know. I'd be taking a guess, and I'm not a good guesser.
Well, yeah, we've already established that. Bailment describes a legal relationship in common law where physical possession of personal property, also known as a chattel, is transferred from one person, the bailor, to another person, the bailee, who subsequently has possession of the property. It arises when a person gives property to someone else for safekeeping, and the cause of action independent of contract or a tort. So basically, if I give you a piece of property for safekeeping, that the relationship between us would be called a bailment at common law. Now, a lot of this has been changed by statute and things like that.
So you're giving it to me to hold on to you.
Right.
To hold on to for you, not giving it to me to keep, like
exactly.
a gift or something.
Exactly. So I would be the bailor. You would be the bailee. Which reminds me.
Beetle Bailey?
Do you like Bailey's?
Bailey's?
Yeah.
You mean the restaurant?
No, the drink.
Oh, the drink. Yeah, I like the drink.
Do you ever drink it from a shoe?
No, I never drink from a shoey. I saw that they were trying to get, what's her name? Casey, what's her name that's got that song out now? Casey something. She's a singer. And they tried to, in Australia, try to get her to drink a shoey.
Oh, do a shoey?
Yeah, do a shoey on stage out of a boot or something like that. And she wouldn't do it the first night. And then the second night, she was appearing somewhere else in Australia. And they started the same chant, so she did it.
My initiation to the Marshall soccer team was to do a shoey.
Yeah.
I was unfortunately the first freshman to do the shoey. So when I was doing the shoey, there were actually bits of grass that were also in the shoey. It was actually a used soccer cleat. It was pretty gross.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So...
I thought there's no hazing allowed in college.
Oh no, it was allowed
in those days.
Yeah,
back right
in those
now.
Days. Well, it's funny there was no hazing in my fraternity, but there was hazing on the soccer team a little bit. So, the drinking beer out of a shoe is not that bad. If I had not,
it's not that bad, huh?
If I had not wanted to do it, I would have said, I refuse. No shoey for Mikey. Actually, no one's ever called me Mikey, so.
I've called you Mikey Bud before.
Well, that's true. It's different. Your family.
Oh, okay.
No, I was talking about this show called... there's a guy named Old Greg. He's like a... Called somebody a fuzzy little man peach. Asked him if he drinks Bailey's out of a shoe. Never seen that?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I thought you were referring to a shoey.
No, but that's close. So, yeah, but basically in a bailment... Possession, but not title, of the actual piece of property is passed. So I'm not giving it to you. You're just watching it for me.
Kind of like your stuff you left in my basement, huh?
That's true. Yeah. You have a reasonable duty of care and delivery with regards to that property.
I want duty on your property.
And like I said, it's not like a contract where you're selling or giving something to somebody. As I said, it's only just kind of transfer of temporary possession of it. And to create a bailment, there have to be certain elements.
Helium and oxygen.
No. Oh. Those are good guesses, though. You're getting closer. You're getting lighter.
I need my periodic table.
So to create a bailment, the bailee must both intend to possess and actually physically possess the bailable chattel.
Chattel. Yeah. I always think of that like cattle. Cattle used to be chattel.
Cattle used to be chattel.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were convert. There was conversion.
Yeah, there's a sheep conversion to cattle to sheep chattel.
Do you know what conversion means at common law?
When you convert it from being yours to mine.
Like theft?
Yeah.
Yeah. Conversion is theft, pretty much. So like I said, bailment is something that was all throughout common law, but basically in this day and age, it doesn't really exist as it did before. So, but one kind of circumstance where you might have that situation arise today would be kind of leaving your car with a valet. So if you leave your car in an unattended parking garage, usually that's not really like a bailment. That's kind of different. But if you're actually giving possession of it to a valet, then it's kind of a bailment type situation.
Well, that's true. Otherwise, you're just parking.
There's no such thing as free parking.
No, you have to pay for your parking.
So there's different kinds of bailments. There's a bailment for hire, where basically the bailee, the person taking the property, is paid.
Mm-hmm.
There's a constructive bailment, where there's a circumstance creating an obligation on the custodian to protect the goods. So that might arise if, like, you have some other duty and basically it arises that you need to protect these goods and it's reasonable for you to do that. That would be kind of a constructive bailment.
Duty.
A gratuitous bailment.
A gratuitous one.
Where you basically take that on for free. A divisible bailment, where the bailee is responsible for an item, but not items that are not expected to be inside. So, like, if you ask a valet to park your car for you, but you have a glove box full of diamonds, so, you know, it might be reasonable for the valet to take care of your car, but not to sit on a $250,000 of diamonds in a glove box that they don't know about.
Hmm.
And also, we have a lot of things in this day and age where there's signs that say you're responsible for your own goods.
Personal, not responsible. They have that, like, you know, if you get your locker broken into at the Y or something like
that. Right, and that's kind of the same theory of this bailment we're talking about.
So. If you're using their locker, you've established a bailment with them because they're their locker and your stuff's in it?
No, probably not. Because there's not actually somebody physically taking possession of it. I think that's the one issue you're missing there.
What if there was a valet in the locker room? And you gave him your clothes and he put them in the locker for you.
Yeah, like you take off your underwear and hand them to somebody and hang them up for you.
Yeah.
That would be weird.
Here, James, would you please hang these? They're my tidy whities.
I will take physical possession. It is my duty to take care of your duty-free undies.
Duty-free. They're duty-free undies, you know?
Duty-free undies. Tax-free.
I will only handle duty-free ones, if you please, sir.
There's also involuntary quasi-bailment or bailment by casualty where someone is basically forced to be the bailee. And I don't exactly have a great example of that, but there's no duty of reasonable care in a situation like that. So,
like if you're walking across a bridge and somebody says, here, hold this, and then they jump off the bridge, you don't necessarily have to hold it? Would that maybe be it?
That'd be... a good example. Then you throw it off the bridge after.
Yeah.
Here you go.
I'm not going to do it. You picked the wrong guy.
I do not accept your involuntary bailment.
You're by death.
Smite thee. So there's some different examples of bailments. And there's one that's maybe for a mutual benefit of the parties. Could be when there's an exchange of different performances. So basically...
I will dance for you, and you will sing for me, and whoever does the best wins the bailment. Is that what kind of performance you mean?
Well, like there could be a bailment for the repair of an item, and the owner is basically paying to have the repair accomplished. So there's kind of a mutual exchange of goods and services in that situation, I guess.
When you said they had to perform performances for each other, I was just thinking, you know, in the arts.
An example of a gratuitous one might be like if you are, what?
I don't know, gratuitous, it just conjures up strange images. Like in a movie, gratuitous sex, you know?
Yeah.
It's not necessary to the plot line, it's just in there.
It's bonus.
Yeah.
So basically if...
I guess
it might be more, you can pronounce it graciously.
Graciously?
Yeah.
Instead of gratuitously?
I think it's spelled the same, isn't it?
I'd have to look at it. I don't think so.
This is a question. This is a good question.
Gratuitous has T's and gracious has a C-I-O-U.
Well, but I think if you're turning it into an adverb.
You better get your lawyer spell check on that.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, anyway, if you're doing it out of the kindness of your heart, how about that?
Well, I mean, I can see what I'm assuming that it means is like if you volunteer, this guy's like, man, I need to go in here and do this, but I don't know what to do with my bicycle. There's nowhere to lock it up. Oh, hey, I'll take care of that for you. Leave it with me, and I'll take care of that for you while you go in. I'll wait right here. Don't worry about it.
my last name's actually Bailey.
You want a drink?
Now, there's an interesting case that talks about bailments, and it's got a good name. All old cases have a good name. That's one of the prerequisites. Coggs v. Bernard from 1704.
Those are the good kind from back then because they talked so good. They had good talkers in them days, not like we are now.
So this is a landmark case, like I said, from back in the olden days.
Well-established law.
It is well-established law. You were paying attention last week. And... basically, it talks about the different duties owed by a bailee.
Duties. There's a lot of duties this week.
There are. It's in something in the water.
It's like going to the dog park.
So there is... but it talks about the different obligations...
All right.
...owed by the person who is holding onto the property of another. So William Bernard undertook to carry several barrels of brandy belonging to John Coggs from Brooks Market, Holborn, to Water Street, just south of the Strand, so about a half a mile.
Okay.
His undertaking was gratuitous. That is, he was not offered any compensation for his work. And as he was unloading the brandy at the Water Street cellar, a barrel was staved and 150 gallons was lost.
Oh, man, I'd lose it into my mouth.
I'm not sure what staved mean, but I assume it means punctured.
Well, a stave, though, is one of the up and down timbers in there. So maybe the stave came out or something like that. It came loose. You know, the hoops hold the staves in.
The hoops hold the staves in, you say?
Yeah, you know, the metal hoops around the barrel. Yeah. And the staves fit in there. And if it's like when we saw how they make the whiskey barrels, the bourbon barrels, there's nothing else that holds them together. Those things are just fitted in there, and they fit flush up against each other, and then the hoops are just wedged on around them. There's nothing else that goes in there because they don't want to contaminate the alcohol that's inside.
Well, according to the dictionary contained in my handheld pocket computer.
Yes.
My iPhone. Stave means to break something by forcing it inward or piercing it roughly.
Hmm.
So.
Well, so it's pierced.
He pierced 150 gallons of brandy.
And he said, well, I was doing it for free. Sorry.
Tough luck.
Yeah.
So Coggs was a little upset about this, and he brought a cause of action against Bernard, basically saying that he had undertaken to carry the barrels but had spilled them through his own negligence. So I guess he must have said it was staved because of his negligence.
Yes.
I want to use that in a sentence.
Okay.
No, like
he staved me through the heart.
Okay. Did you turn into a werewolf or something? Or? Or
Jackson Brown sang about that. Oh, won't you stave just a little bit longer?
Is that Jackson Brown?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It seems more doo-woppy, like more...
Well, it's comes in at the end of the loadout.
Oh, okay. I'll take your word on that.
Okay.
I had a Jackson Brown CD, but I don't know what happened to it. I listened to it a couple times.
Was it running on empty?
It might have been. No, I think it was The Pretender. Is that one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there we go. So, basically, the judge found that Mr. Bernard, the defendant, was negligent in carrying the tasks and therefore was liable as a bailee. But the judge made clear that his responsibility to Coggs was not formally contractual in nature, since he received no consideration. Instead, his responsibility rested on the trust that Coggs placed in him to use due care in transporting the casks, and by his tacit acceptance of that trust by taking the casks into his custody. Thus, because Bernard acted negligently when he was under a responsibility to use care, he was held to be in breach of trust.
What does that cost you?
150 gallons of brandy? Back in 1704?
Well, I'm just mean, what does that cost you as far as... In other words, if he had paid him,
right.
You know, I'm giving you X number of dollars to take this over there, and then he didn't do it, I could see them saying, you don't get paid. You didn't do what you're supposed to do. But if you were offered to do it for free, and then something happened, yeah, he was responsible, but, you know, what can you charge? He was doing it for free.
Right, but he actually undertook that task because he wanted to.
Why?
Nobody forced him.
I wonder why he did that.
Maybe he thought he was going to get to stave some of that brandy a little bit later.
Yeah, maybe that's where he staved it, was into his own pitchers and stuff.
Now, the interesting thing about this case is that basically this is where the statement of different categories of bailments comes from common law.
So he didn't break a contract. He broke a trust.
Right. It was a breach of trust.
Yes.
Which he undertook under his own volition.
Because basically, if there had been money involved, then it would have been a contract. Whether it was verbal or written, it would still have been a contract had been made.
Correct. Yeah, there would have been some sort of a...
So he couldn't say there was a contract because he was getting nothing in return.
Right. There would have been a breach of contract. And the interesting thing about that would have been is, well, maybe not so much in that day and age if there had been a contract, but a lot of times... Whenever you have contracts, they limit the amount of damages to the amount of the contract itself.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
You can't basically sue somebody for something that exceeds the price of what the contract is that you're doing it.
Right.
So they do also sometimes put in, you know, incidental, consequential, and liquidated damages clauses in contracts as well, which kind of outline saying that, hey, we can't figure out what a reasonable damage would be in case this doesn't happen by a certain date, but we're going to go ahead and guess that it's going to be this much. And so,
well, if this guy had insurance, the insurance probably would have covered it.
Well, and I was going to get to that later, but I think that's probably the reason why this whole law of bailment has kind of gone by the wayside to a certain degree, is because insurance is much more prevalent now than it used to be back in the 1700s. Back then, you had to have these common law theories on different things like this because you just had to. They want insurance. But now people have insurance, so it's not as big a deal.
I wonder when insurance was established, because you got to figure they didn't have it in the 1700s.
Well, I think they did. I just don't think they had it. It wasn't as prevalent. I think they insured ships going across the seas.
Well, yeah, maybe so, something like that. But not personal property and stuff like that. Probably not even home insurance.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think they'd have been that far progressed where they would have a uniform way to do that.
Well, they were living in mud huts back then.
Yeah. What are they worth? What's mud worth?
Not much. So the judge in this case basically laid out the fact that there are six different kinds of bailments. The first, and I like the names of these, a bare naked bailment of goods.
That's where the bare naked ladies came from.
Maybe so. Delivered by one man to another to keep for the use of the bailor. And this I call a depositum.
Depositum.
Yep. And it's the sort of bailment which I mentioned in Southcote's case. The second sort is when goods or chattels that are useful are lent to a friend gratis to be used by him, and this is called commoditum.
Commoditum.
Because the thing is to be restored in specie.
Like, so that's like when you borrow a guy's shovel or something.
Yeah, a shovel.
So that you can dig a hole, and then you got to give him a shovel back the way you found it.
Exactly.
You can't tear it up or keep it in your tool shed.
That's right. The third sort is when goods are left with a bailee to be used by him for hire. This is called locatio et conductio, and the lender is called locator, and the borrower is called conductor. This guy was having a good time with
this. Boy, I'll say, he's really put a lot of thought into this for 150 gallons of burnt brandy.
The fourth sort, when goods or chattels are delivered to another as a pawn to be a security to him for money borrowed by him by the bailor, this is called in Latin vadium, and in English a pawn or a pledge.
It's like, here, you can hold my prize pig until I bring you this back.
Now, and this is one theory that still is prevalent today, but it's actually been codified in a lot of laws regarding pawn shops.
If
you pawn an item, they are essentially the bailee is under a duty to keep that piece of property in the same reasonable.
So if you pawn your pig, that pig better be in good shape. You don't want to come back in and get a plate of bacon.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't be frying up my pig now. And the fifth sort is when goods or chattels are delivered to be carried or something is to be done about them for a reward to be paid by the person who delivers them to the bailee, who is to do the thing about them. What that means, I'm not really sure.
Do the thing about them.
Yeah. The sixth sort is is when there is a delivery of good or chattels to somebody who is to carry them or do something about them gratis without any rewards for such his work or carriage, which is this present case. I mention these things not so much that they are all of them so necessary in order to maintain the proposition which is to be proved, as to clear the reason of the obligation which is upon persons in cases of trust.
I think this guy talked in circles
a little bit, but law is confusing sometimes.
They like to keep it that way so that us common people don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Now, basically, what this was important, though, because it overturned that Southcott's case, which was mentioned previously. And that case held that, in general, the bailee was strictly liable for any damage or loss to goods in their possession, even if the goods were stolen from him by force. So, basically, in this case, a general bailee was only liable if they had been negligent. So that was kind of what changed the ruling. And despite the reappraisal of the standard of liability of general bailees, the judge refused to reconsider the long-standing common law rule that held common carriers strictly liable for any loss or damage to bailed property in their possession. Although admitting the rule was hard, he justified it by saying, "This rule is a politic establishment contrived by the policy of law for the safety of all persons, the necessity of whose affairs oblige them to trust these sorts of persons, carriers, that they may be safe in their ways of dealing, for else these carriers might have an opportunity of undoing all persons that had any dealings with them by combining with thieves and yet doing it in such a clandestine manner as would not be possible to be discovered. And this is the reason the law is founded upon that point.
So what they're saying is whether it's harsh or not, it's too hard to discern whether the guy might have been in cahoots with whoever got the 150 gallons. Did they bust it on purpose? Did somebody steal it? All this other kind of stuff. So it's better just hold them responsible.
Yeah.
So that way there's no leeway.
Yeah, to a certain degree. And, you know, there has been some sort of negligent, that they weren't necessarily strictly liable, but there had to be some sort of negligent. And there was a Sir John Powell that concurred in the decision, and basically there was the famous dictum, which I had not heard of until I read this, which I might have this tattooed on me. Let us consider the reason of the case, for nothing is law that is not reason. That's pretty deep, isn't it?
Yeah, I could just see you getting yourself in trouble, though, walking in a bar and asking ladies, hey, you want to see my dictum? You would probably be put out of there pretty fast.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, I'm a lawyer. Trust me, it's okay.
They're treating me like chattel.
So, but that's kind of a lot of interesting things that are brought up in there, if you think about it, as far as responsibility for people on different property and whatnot. And, you know, I think what it boils down to in this day and age is that you're, and again, we're coming back to the thing we always come back to, you're held to a standard of reasonable care. And that's always a good guiding principle when you're talking about law, I think.
Especially if you're in the hospital.
Yeah, especially.
That's what you want. I found this that is like, it's the Anglo-American theory on property itself. And I thought, you know, like we talked about how they talk real good back in them days.
Uh-huh.
You know, you take this stuff for granted. Your stuff is your stuff. Your property is your property.
Right.
Why would you need anyone to define or come up with a theory of how we obtain property or why something is your property? Yet, you had a period of time when people were developing our laws where they had to reason out why this is a good assumption.
Yeah.
So James Wilson, he was a U.S. Supreme Court justice and a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. In 1790 and 1791, he undertook a survey of the philosophical grounds of American property law. He proceeds from two premises. Every crime includes an injury, and every injury includes a violation of a right. The government's role in protecting property depends upon an idea of right. Wilson traces the history of property in his essay, On the History of Property. In his lecture, Of the Natural Rights of Individuals, he articulates related contemporary theory. That theory was brought to a focus on the question of whether man exists for the sake of government or government for the sake of man, a distinction which may derive from or lead to the question of natural and absolute rights, and whether property is one of them. While he doubts this is so, he nonetheless states, in his unrelated state, man has a natural right to his property, to his character, to liberty, and to safety. James Wilson asks whether the primary and principal object in the institution of government was to acquire new rights by human establishment, or was it by a human establishment to acquire a new security for the possession or the recovery of those rights. He indicates a preference for the latter. In the opening sentence of On the History of Property, he states quite clearly, property is the right or lawful power which a person has to a thing. He then divides that right into three degrees: possession, which is the lowest, possession and use, and possession, use, and disposition, which is the highest. Further, he states, man is intended for action. Useful and skillful industry is the soul of an active life, but industry should have her just reward. That reward is property, for of useful and active industry, property is the natural result. So that was how he went through and reasoned out the rights of property. When you think about that, that it has the three states, and the lowest is possession, and then possession and use, possession, use, and disposition. In other words, you're saying, when I die, here's who's going to get my stuff.
Right.
So that's what the disposition is. So, and if it's just sitting around, that, like, you know, it's an old car sitting out in a field somewhere, and somebody else comes along and they decide they could do something with that. Well, if you just let it sit there for years, sure, it's yours, but it's the lowest level of possession it would be.
Right.
Whereas if you were working on that car, then that's possession and use. If you're working on that car and made it work and left it to your son or grandson, now it's possession, use, and disposition.
Well, it's also a good theory as to waste that can be like a an, with regard to a society.
Exactly.
To avoid waste.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about the property rights as viewed in common law and things like that and how it was viewed. Basically, at common law, we've talked about this before, burglary was the breaking and entering into someone else's home. I think it was at nighttime.
At night.
Mm-hmm. With the intent to commit a crime therein. Mm-hmm. So at common law, though, if you basically broke into someone's house at night, so you fit all the other elements, but you were breaking in to recover your own property, that actually would not have fit the common law definition of burglary.
Yeah, because you weren't going to commit a crime.
Exactly. You're not committing a crime. You're just recovering your own property in there.
What if you were just breaking in to eat a sandwich?
Was it your sandwich?
Well, maybe they were giving them out free at a party and had some left over.
So it was a fungible sandwich?
It was a communal sandwich.
Do you know what fungible means?
It has mushrooms on it because that's a fungus.
Fungible basically means that they're things that are mutually interchangeable. Like you can't really discern one from the other. So if there was a plate full of sandwiches,
yeah,
and you claimed that one of them was yours, they could be fungible sandwiches.
That's right. Is it my sandwich? Is it your sandwich? I don't know. Let's both take a bite.
Ooh, that is fungible.
So my whammo.
So yeah, but that I always thought that was very interesting about one of those elements of burglary at common law, and that's one of those like kind of trick questions they'll try to throw at you on the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, so and so did this, this, and this. Check off all the elements to get their own golf clubs. Is it burglary? The answer is no.
The guy broke in to get his shovel back that we talked about earlier.
That's right.
He had to bury the body.
Yeah, it was his duty.
It was his duty. Duty on him. Oh, those were duty-free shorts.
So have you ever heard the phrase, possession's 9/10 of the law?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's not true.
Really? You got to have 10/10?
That's right. You got to have title or a deed.
Oh, you can't just say, I got it. Finders, keepers, losers, sweepers doesn't work?
Nope, can't say that.
Man.
But I always, that's one of the kind of jokes I always say with my friends is when somebody says something, but I thought possession was 9/10. I read somewhere possession's 9/10 of the law. Everybody shakes their head like, oh, there's Meadows telling that joke again. I'm good for that, though.
Well, you have to have all 10 tenths.
100%?
Yeah, all of it. That's a shame, because I've used that for a long time.
Possession's 9/10 of the law?
Yeah, nobody's ever called me on it.
Well, it actually isn't written down anywhere, like, as far as in a law book of sorts.
Well, it's just like the golden rule. It's not written down anywhere either, but it still applies. Catch Me If You Can. That was a good one, too.
That book?
No, just that saying.
Oh. The book and movie was pretty good, too.
Yeah, with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Now, sometimes if you give somebody some property and they fail to return it and it's still yours, you might actually have to file a lawsuit to go back and get it.
Sure.
So you can allege different ways. You could basically say that they have converted your property, which we talked about. Essentially, they've stolen it. Because they basically converted it from yours.
He put his name on it. He had a label maker and put his name on it. That was mine.
They've converted it from yours to theirs. So you could sue them for conversion. You could sue them for something called replevin or trover.
Or trover.
Yeah, those are kind of older common law names.
He replevined and trovered me.
And you still see replevin in some places.
That sounds like a law firm.
Replevin and trover?
Yeah.
I wonder what they specialize in.
Do we cheat them and how?
Replevin and trover would be instances where you're asking the court to give you your property back. This happens a lot of times if there's a situation where maybe you've left your car with a auto mechanic or something along those lines, and you're suing to get it back, like, you know, replevin.
Yeah, so. I want to be replevined.
Yeah.
That sounds like replenished.
Replenished?
Yeah.
Well, it probably has some of the similar
Latin basis.
Yes, Latin basis. So, yeah, that's kind of a property law and bailments and whatnot.
Well, I was wondering where this comes up so much. Because, like I said, when I first did my research, I was not coming up with anything for this. But here's what I did find it.
You finally looked it up in your Funk and Wagnalls?
Yes. Personal property disputes, You know what the main source of them is in legal aspects? I mean, for that have legal outcomes? I mean,
the main source of personal property disputes that people argue over. Is that the question?
Yes.
I'm going to guess two different things, which I think is fair, given that there's a lot of different stuff out there this could be.
But you're a lawyer. You should have the inside track.
I'm going to say either pets or guns.
Well, all right, you were being a little too specific.
Oh.
What I was looking for, the answer we were looking for was inheritance.
Oh, well,
yeah. Families fighting with each other over the parents' tchotchkes or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
That you have people that you have several different situations. One is, like, maybe the parent is dying, mm-hmm. and somebody walks away with a set of prize dishes or something like that, and they say, well, they told me I could take it before we moved them to the nursing home.
Right.
They said I could have that. No, wait a minute. Those were mine. I asked for those a long time ago. Well, too bad. I got them. And then the other thing is, once they die, and maybe they just said, you know, I leave my stuff to my children. Now you got to decide who gets what.
Well, see, when you said that, I was thinking I think of that more in the context as like a probate estate manner, less of an actual lawsuit where you're fighting over.
Well, it's personal property.
Yeah,
it is. And you're arguing over, and usually it comes down to certain items. It's not just like saying I want X amount of dollars. And they're saying that a lot of times you can either go through and itemize everything, or, you know, so that you don't have this, or you could say anything that's in dispute amongst people, I want it sold and the money split evenly.
Right.
Something like that, to try to save your family from going through those things. Because you'd think, you know, families, you wouldn't have that problem, but that's the worst thing you can get, because everybody has their own opinion about these things.
It's actually the worst time for families, because they're experiencing the death of a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to cling on to different things that remind them of that person, hopefully not just the value of them. And, I can definitely see that, and I would agree with that 100%. But I was thinking in more in the context of, like, just an actual property.
That's
my gun. No, that's my dog.
But that's what they were talking about, was the different ways that you can protect yourself from having these type things there. They said another common one is, like, if the person dies, has a surviving spouse that was not the children's mother.
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of times they'll leave their stuff to the children. And the wife is saying, wait a minute. You know, the dad leaves it to the children, and then the wife says, wait a minute, I'm living here.
Yeah.
This is my stuff. I'm living here.
I've lived here for this long.
Yeah. And you can't just come and take the stuff. I'm still using that.
Yeah. That's my microwave.
Yeah. I'm eating off those plates you're taking out of here. You can't have those right now. But then that becomes a problem. So a lot of times you have to look at that. And some states have laws that say you can't do that. That you have like it's tenantable rights or something like that, that you are both tenants of that property and of the personal property using it. Therefore, you can't pass it on to somebody out from under her while she's still living there.
Yeah.
So, but it depends on, you need to check on that in your state, what the state laws do, if they protect you or not as a spouse.
Right. A lot of times, this is something that spouses talk about, you know, before with a good estate planning type situation, where they talk about certain things they want to go to certain kids and mm-hmm. whatnot, especially in a situation where you don't have all the same kids.
Right.
From but they're both the biological parents and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But also the thing you can do too, and a lot of times you can make like a kind of a list that goes along with your will, which actually divvies up different personal property if you know there's certain items you want to pass along.
Well, that's what they say is the best, but, you know, who's got time to make a list of every single thing you acquire?
Yeah,
you know, to say, my old popcorn popper goes to Joe. And
I've had clients that have come in and amended things over and over and over, that they're just constantly, you know, changing, and you know, it ebbs and flows with how
they feel about
how
people.
Mad they are, and how bad they're people.
They didn't come visit me at Christmas. I'm cutting them out. I want everything to go to the other one and change it.
There has been a client or two that's been like that, so they are always good for return business. So, but the one thing you always have to watch out for as an attorney, I've learned, is that when people come in and they want to argue about different personal property items, especially in the context of like a parent passing away or things like that, and they say, well, you know, so-and-so took the old popcorn maker, It didn't worth anything, but it's the principle.
Yeah.
You know, that is a classic line that I hear, and it's like, well, I don't work on principle. If you're willing to pay me for your principle, then I'll do it. And yeah. Here's what your principle is going to cost.
Well, and that was another point they made in that same article, that that's one of the main reasons, that very rarely is there anything, when you're talking about personal property and stuff, that's worth going to court over. You're going to end up losing money on it in the long run.
Yeah. There is one case in particular that the person who sued my client was a friend of the plaintiff, and I don't think they charged the plaintiff anything to do this. They did it as a favor.
Mm-hmm.
And the defendant was a friend of mine, and I didn't charge them to do anything because they were a friend. I said, oh, I'll see what I can take care of this. Well, that left the attorneys in a very
precarious awkward
situation, because
you were a gratuitous attorney.
That's right. Neither attorney was getting paid for it, and neither so client had a stake in the game. Yeah. So there was no incentive to settle
Stave.
This. Yeah, there was no incentive to settle this. It was like, well, this is gonna. And
it was like the Beanie Baby case.
Yeah, and so this other attorney and I just basically beat each other in the face until we kind of just called a truce, and the case just went away.
You saw them standing around the corner looking at you and snickering, and you realized you two were the chumps, huh?
Exactly, pretty much. But the case eventually got dismissed. But it was...
You all came to the conclusion, there's too much duty here.
Yeah. It was one of those kinds of cases that basically, if the parties actually had to pay money for the case itself, it would have settled a long time ago.
Yeah. So you learned a valuable lesson from that, I'll bet.
I did. Make sure your client has a skin in the game.
That's right.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs, 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 Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is a part of the show where I asked Tommy about different legal terms we talked about.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I know I'm going to fail these because you had so many weird terms. I'll never remember all those, commodium and stuff.
That's why this was such a great topic.
Yeah.
So what is a bailment? I asked you this before. Can you tell me now?
Well, a bailment is basically an obligation between one person and another to keep somebody else's stuff, but you don't have possession of it. I mean, you don't have the right to keep it. You're just keeping it for them, and you have to give it back.
Right. So you actually have possession of it, but not ownership.
Correct.
Let me clarify that for you there.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I was trying to say.
So
you got it, but you don't got it. You don't get to keep it. You keep it for till they tell you you can keep it.
Let me clarify that for you.
What he meant to say, Your Honor.
Yeah, Judge, no. What my client was trying to say.
They don't let you do that, though, do they?
Sometimes.
They're not supposed to, though.
Well, it depends. When you're making your argument.
Because then you're putting words in their mouth.
Well.
You're cleaning up what they said.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's my job.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sometimes I have to act like, you know, my client's my puppet. And
it's
I have
your
to,
duty.
I have to stick my hand in my puppet and make him talk. Maybe that was a bad analogy.
Yeah, you don't want to stick your hand in where the puppet goes there.
So if you are giving the property to somebody else, what is your term? What are you called?
You're the bailer.
That's right.
And they're the bailee.
That is right. And also, what else is Bailey's?
A drink that we like to put in our coffee.
That's right. It's a creamy goodness.
Yes.
Okay, so can you name a different kind of bailments? I mentioned a bunch of different kinds, and some of them had some weird terms.
Well, one's a gratuitous one.
That's right.
That means that you don't get paid nothing. You just, for some reason, opened your damn mouth and said you'd do it, and now you're responsible.
That's what I get for sticking my nose in something that didn't belong.
That's right. Or your hand in your puppet. And then there's one where you're getting paid for it.
Yeah. The bailment for hire.
Bailment for hire. It's like a gun for hire.
That's right.
And then there's one... Because I don't know, I'm about out of them from there. The ones because it's your job. I don't know, but that's for hire. So I don't know.
Right. Well, another was constructive bailment, where basically, for some reason, you actually have to take care of the property for some other reason that you're on the hook for.
As you know, on the railroad, we used to have constructive placement, which is like a customer's car came in and say that it was supposed to arrive on the 5th,
uh-huh.
and it actually came in and you placed it there on the 4th, we would place it under constructive placement, which basically meant, hey, it's yours. We know we said it'd be there on the 5th, but it's there early. So you got it now.
Right.
And the clock starts running on how long you have to empty it out before you start getting charged for it.
Well, that's probably also has to do with liability purposes, too. Yeah. You know, you've actually tendered delivery at that point, so.
Could be, but that's what we called it, was constructive placement. And I actually, bet that derives from that term.
It probably does, and there's probably a lot of different bailment issues that arise with the railroad as a common carrier, because mm-hmm. you're constantly...
You're responsible, right?
Yeah, you're taking care of other people's goods for them, basically.
Yeah, that's right. So. And their bads.
The other one that we really like, which is another name for gratuitous, was called commoditatum.
Easy for you to say.
Not really. But anyway, that was what old Judge Holt was talking about in his case from 1704.
Yeah, he had all them weird names. Yeah. I think he was just trying to sound intelligent.
Vadium, Lucatio et Conductio. All these great ones. So, if you are a bailee, mm-hmm. what is your duty of care?
You have to not...
At common law.
You have to not be negligent.
That's right. And that was what was held.
Right.
Essentially, don't be negligent. Use a reasonable expectation of care.
Yeah, like if a hurricane came and caused the loss, that's not your fault.
No, that is a act of God.
Yeah, but if you just kind of left something unattended and somebody walked off with it, then you're responsible.
Sometimes if you hear the term act of God, it also refers to a different phrase called force majeure, which is a Latin or French, which basically means superior force, which there's some sort of force majeure that takes place, that it's basically out of your control.
We had that on the railroad, too.
Did you?
Yeah, force majeure. That's when you're interchanging cars with another carrier. Like when we would transfer cars over to the N&W, we would place them on the interchange site, and even if they weren't available to come get them, we would force majeure the cars, which meant you're responsible for them now.
Maybe that's force merger.
Nope, force majeure. We had all them fancy words on the railroad. None of us knew what they meant, but we said them.
Really?
Yeah.
I find that astounding.
It is. It is. We're going to force majeure them cars on the N&W. They're going to see. They're going to see what's all about.
Well, I guess, I mean, if you take the actual translation of it, it means superior force, mm-hmm. which basically means that you have the superior force to do what you want with that.
Right.
So, wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So you had no idea what that meant. You just...
Nope. All I knew is it was when we placed cars in interchange, and it was their responsibility then.
So you kind of bullied them.
Right. To get them off the interchange. Because that's a mutual track both railroads, you know, shared mm-hmm. to interchange cars.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. All them railroad terms.
That's going to do it for legal briefs. I actually learned something in legal briefs today.
You learned about the railroad terms.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
All of our listeners are always happy when we learn about Tommy's railroad stories.
Yeah. You never know what might come out of those. Glad hands and ticklers and... angle cocks, you know, there's all kinds of things that you got to watch out for.
Whoa, this is a family show here. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been... Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.